Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to BikeRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.BikeRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, I have a very special guest. His name is Dr. Amit Goswami, and we are going to be talking about his new book called Quantum Creativity, Think Quantum, Be Creative. In this mind-expanding work, physicist Dr. Amit Goswami explores the world of human creativity, the ultimate source of joy and fulfillment, through the lens of quantum physics, and offers up a unique way to nurture and enhance your own creativity, combining the art of creativity with the objectivity of science. Quantum creativity uses empirical data to support this new method of thinking and outlines how to harness our innate abilities in order to live more creatively. Dr. Goswami is a professor of theoretical nuclear physics, retired from the University of Oregon, where he served since 1968. He is a pioneer in the new paradigm of science called science within consciousness, an idea he explicated in his seminal book, The Self-Aware Universe, where he also solved the quantum measurement problem of the famous observer effect. Dr. Goswami's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description, as well as a link to his website, which is amitgoswami.org. So with that, I'd like to welcome Amit to the show. Good day, sir. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Robert. I'm delighted.
Well, you know, I have been anxiously awaiting this day since Sarah contacted me back in July. So I thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show years ago when we talked about quantum activism. The whole idea of creativity is one that is a passion of mine. So I'd like to start with, you know, just with a couple definitions to begin with. First of all, today, you know, many people think of creativity as something that is a brain phenomenon, and you say that it's a human phenomenon. Would you mind talking about what the difference between the two is?
Well, if creativity were a brain phenomenon, then we could only have explore creativity in terms of the old. In other words, all your heart would have is a combination of old ideas, and we could just reshuffle that, and that would be called creativity. Now, agreed that many pieces of work, creative work that we call creative, fall in that category, like romance novels. They're all based on ideas of love. That is common in the culture. This is why people relate to them so very well. And that falls into this category of machine creativity. But there is also the creativity of Einstein, Van Gogh, Picasso, Mozart. Where does that kind of creativity that really is completely new, which is based on something that just didn't exist before? E equals mc squared is a law that Einstein discovered. But except for E, M, C, and 2 and equal, those things are symbols that are already in the language. But except for that, the content, the meaning, and the context in which this equation applies is absolutely new. There is just not one shred of thinking that recognizes that time slows down on a moving spaceship, which is the way of viewing time that gives us this new idea that energy and matter are one and the same thing. So it is this kind of creativity, the creativity of fundamental nature, where we are discovering an archetype like in Einstein's case, it's truth. In Mozart's case, it's beauty, love. But the archetypes can be different. But it's always the archetypal new context, archetypal context that is involved in real creativity. Within that, if we compromise a little and take other people's archetypal context and using that, we become creative to find new meaning, that also involves some of quantum thinking. We can shorten the process even of that secondary situational creativity by using the quantum thinking. So there is value in that too. I'm not saying that machine creativity is completely useless, but the most important fundamental creativity is certainly archetypal creativity, which machines cannot do, which we cannot do if we keep in our conditioned context.
Yeah. So now you've mentioned quantum thinking. Exactly what is that? I mean, how does that differ from our regular brain functioning thinking?
Exactly. This is the fundamental question, and I'm glad that you are getting into it right away. So let's get into machine thinking. Machine thinking, everybody okay. knows, because although you may not have written a program, I'm talking to the listener here, but you know that computer programs work algorithmically. You read a logical, mm-hmm. rational, one step-by-step process. That's the way
right.
Newtonian thinking, or this thinking based on ordinary algorithmic process goes. Another way of putting it is that this is the scientific method of doing things. We do step by step. We take an idea, and then we try it and see. But in this way of reasoning, we have to take one idea at a time. We have to base the algorithm, deduce whatever I can from the algorithm, but one idea at a time always. In quantum thinking, the whole idea is different, because quantum thinking recognizes that quantum is involved even in the nature of thought. And because thought, behind a thought, there is a possibility wave of meaning. Quantum physics recognizes that. Quantum physics says just material objects are waves of possibility. Behind a particular object that we see, there is a whole bunch of possibilities before we manifest the object in that particular place that we see it. So recognizing this helps us to recognize that all of our experiences are based on quantum possibilities. Thoughts are based on quantum possibilities of meaning. So where does these possibilities reside? This is the question. Because we never experience these possibilities. We experience a concrete thought. We only see the electron always at one place. We never see it in all these different places, that is, the waves electron can exist. So where do these waves reside? So from the get-go, we have recognized that the waves must reside outside of space and time in a domain where communication is instantaneous. The experimental verification of the idea came in 1982. A group of French physicists led by Alain Aspect did this experiment. And since then, the experiment has been repeated zillions of times, and now it is agreed that, yes, this domain of potentiality, where possibility waves reside, is really a domain outside of space and time. And the distinction of this domain is that in this domain, communication is instantaneous. In other words, no signal is needed. And so when do you not need communication? There's only one way that you don't need communication, a signal for communication, and that is when you are communicating with yourself. So this domain of potentiality must be a domain where there is only one thing. Now, what is such a thing? What should such a thing be called? Now, Heisenberg, when he was formulating, when he was discovering quantum physics, he realized that when we measure a wave of possibility to make a manifest actuality, like electron could have many positions as a wave, but when we see it as a particle manifestation, we always see it as at one position. So what is involved then in this, Heisenberg realized, is a change in our knowledge. before measuring, we knew about the electron only vaguely, about possibilities and probabilities. But after we measured it, we knew what the electron is exactly. So it's a change in our knowledge. Now, this word knowledge is very interesting. What processes knowledge in human being? That precisely is what our consciousness is. If you look at the etymological origin of the word consciousness, it came from Latin cum and scire. Scire means to know, cum means with. So consciousness is the vehicle with which we know. So in this way, it becomes very clear that this domain of potentiality is nothing but consciousness, and matter exists as possibilities, mind exists as possibilities within this consciousness. And it is consciousness which changes these possibilities by choosing among the various facets of the possibility wave, the particular actuality that we think at a given time, that we see at a given time, that we feel at a given time, that we intuit at a given time. But behind this experimental collapsing the possibilities into actuality, there is always this multiple facets of the wave of possibility. So when we recognize it, and we also must recognize that this domain of potentiality we never experience. What is that? Psychologists long time ago recognized with the work of Freud and Jung that this domain must be called unconscious, and it does affect our conscious happenings, conscious experience. So in this way, we readily can see that it is consciousness, but does not come with awareness. We are not aware of it. We don't have that subject-object split awareness that we have in manifest space and time. So in this way, quantum physics and what really saying is that if you can make your thinking not only in the conscious domain, but also in the unconscious domain, if you get used to thinking in both domains, if you can make this as a part of your modus operandi, you are much more powerful in your thinking. Why? Because in the domain of possibility, just like the electron can be in many different positions all at the same time, similarly, you can process many different possibilities all at the same time. You don't have to do them one by one, which is very time-consuming. So, in effect, this is much less time-consuming and much more powerful. Why? Because new possibilities can be studied. In the old method, Newtonian method, scientific method, in the normal conscious method, we can only study those things that already are recognized. Here, on the other hand, in the domain of possibility, possibilities interact with possibilities and give rise to completely new possibilities that we have not explored before, and completely new domains which we have not explored before, like the domain of where our intuition comes from. These archetypes we have studied very little. So completely new facets of these archetypes we can discover: truth, beauty, justice, love, goodness, abundance, self, all these are archetypes of our thinking. So this is what I mean by quantum thinking, a combination of conscious and unconscious thinking.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you mentioned it when you explained that I love, you know, it talks really about possibilities, you know, the quantum, you know, really involves possibilities. And, you know, it was, to me, it was very eye-opening to recognize that, you know, you talk about possibilities not only in the material, but also in the meaning, feeling, and intuiting type of realms as well. So, I mean, you talk about a whole range of possibilities, where I think sometimes in today's world we tend to focus on the material, you know, possibilities of things.
And that is our big mistake. And, we are making a big mistake by focusing only on the material.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I also enjoyed in your book when you talked, there was a short place that you talked about the secret to manifestation, and you talked about, you know, law of attraction, and the one comment that you made, and I wrote it down just so that we can talk about it. It says that your intention has a much greater chance of being supported by non-local quantum consciousness if it serves the greater good. So to me, you know, you talked about how more powerful our, ability to live and to have our thoughts manifest in, you know, in the conscious and unconscious, you know, aspects. But it also seems that we also they have a greater chance of coming into being if we kind of get our ego out of the way when it comes to what it is that we want to manifest, correct?
Well, not the ego out of the way entirely. The unnecessary component of the ego out of the way. Ego has two things. Ego has a pattern of learning, a plethora of stuff with which we create. So that background knowledge, that part is essential in creativity. But that's only our patterns of learning. Like if I learn mathematics, I don't throw away the mathematics that is part of my learning repertoire, okay? So an artist cannot draw if he throws away the repertoire of drawing that one has to acquire for years and years of training, right? So that part of the ego we keep. That part of the ego is called character. You have an artist character, I have a scientific character. I'm not talking about throwing that away. But what we have to put aside is that apart from this character, we also develop various personas. And these various personas are not really authentic. We invent them to please others mainly. And this persona interferes with our ability to work with the quantum, non-local, unconscious. That's where our ability and that's where the greater good comes in, because the more we leave away this selfish attempt of pleasing others and catering to our personality, our self-image, the better off we are in terms of becoming creative. And this is where if we dedicate ourselves not to our personal selfish motives, which always serve the persona and the self-image, but dedicate ourselves to the greater good, automatically chances are much, much better that we fall into this quantum unconscious and discover the really new.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, and I understand, you know, we can't throw away the ego or the, you know, the basic building blocks of the tools that we have to, you know, to, you know, venture our craft and but, you know, to me, that when I read that aspect, the vision that came, the image that came into my head was the idea of quantum consciousness, kind of in a way looking down at all of these little people around here with their little consciousnesses and recognizing, well, this guy here, you know, he's going to be able to affect millions of people with that idea. So we're going to put a lot of our energy to helping that come into fruition because it's going to be for the greater good.
Well, yes. I mean, this is very romantic, the way you are picturing it. I'm afraid that okay. I'm a scientist. I don't get such a romantic picture.
Okay.
But to me, it's pretty objective. I mean, all we have to do is to focus on the greater good, and objectively, consciousness comes to our aid. Consciousness is that a subject like us, an individual like us, with a mind like us, which thinks like that. That's my view of it. My view is quite objective. But, you know, scientists think like that. I don't begrudge you. I mean, I actually envy you that you can think like a very personal, godlike creature is looking after.
Well, you know, I mean, it wasn't persona, but I mean, it was just, you know, and I'll take the romantic description at any time. That's great. I think, you know, the whole concept and the whole idea is, you know, focusing on activities and ideas and manifesting, taking actions to manifest that really encompass the greater good, you know. And I think that we're getting to a point where that kind of consciousness is more prevalent than it has been in many years, don't you think?
I think so. I think that the worldview is changing, and a lot of people are opening up to this non-local consciousness and are concerned about the greater good. And we see it all the time. But don't forget, we also see an enormous proliferation of selfish interests, too. So paradoxically, both things are happening simultaneously. And we'll see. My vision is that eventually it's all movement of consciousness, evolution of consciousness, and therefore the movement towards greater good will be the way of the future. But in the past, we may have to struggle for quite a while of people of self-interest. And right now, of course, the people of self-interest are dominating the scene, no question about it. Although many people are engaging in quantum creativity. I'm very happy to say I get letters all the time how many people have declared themselves to be a quantum activist. You know, that is very, very pleasing. And I believe that people are taking quantum worldview very seriously, which is integrative, which is, for the first time in human history, integrates both the religious, spiritual traditions with the scientific traditions.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I believe, you know, it's the selfish acts or the prevalence of those, it's kind of like they're a galvanizing force for the other, for those who are in the quantum consciousness realm. It kind of motivates them into action. You know, I mean, whenever we see an instance of extreme selfish behavior that maybe harms our environment, it galvanizes those against that. You know what I'm saying? So it seems like, you know, that may be one of the purposes for the increase or the visibility of that highly selfish behavior.
Yeah, I'm sure you have a point. And so the thing to recognize here is that the selfish motives are also important. The mistake of the religious view is that it ignores the selfish motive completely. It says kill the ego. No, that's not the way. We cannot kill the ego because ego's character is very important. And if the motivation comes from selfish desire, so be it. We must start there. So a quantum creative starts with selfish motive, but generalizes it very rapidly towards greater good. I mean, but there's no incompatibility. I am part of the greater too. You know, I'm included. If we work for everybody's good, it's not that I'm left out. I mean, I belong to everybody. So we forget that sometimes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Well, now when it comes to the creative process, there's one area that you outlined, four stages of the creative process. Now you talked about when it comes to like mechanical thought, that kind of thing, and the 1, 2, 3. From reading the explanation of the process, it appeared to me that there was, I mean, I can understand particularly with problem solving, you know, that there would be a process that could stimulate creative thinking. And then there's another area where sometimes if it's not necessarily problem solving, and let's just say it's creative expression, you know, that doesn't require, you know, anything other than that muse or that little spark of aha or eureka, you know, to strike. So if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the creative process, and are those two different, you know, like the problem solving versus the, let's say, inspirational, creative aspect?
This is, of course, very important. And this again, I emphasize that I never slight problem solving. Problem solving by itself is also very important. Now, problems arise within given contexts. So in problem solving, we never think that context has to be changed. Like problem solving, when I think of problem solving, I don't know if you have ever taken a physics course, but in physics courses, we give many mathematical problems to test people if they have understood what goes on in the use of the formulas, mathematical formulas that they learned. And so this problem-solving method, you know, economists use that training also uses it, business training also uses it. They give various problems, challenging problems of how to promote a particular product. So that's problem-solving. You have a special region in which you have to work. You've given people's mindset, and these are the people you want to influence. So what kind of propaganda, what kind of publicity, what kind of selling points should you use? That's a problem solving. The context is given. You have a product, you have to sell it. That's context. You have to make money. That's the context. So within that given context, you solve the problem. Whereas when we are inspired by these archetypes, it's different. Like for me, when I was looking at solving the quantum measurement problem, at some point, because some people already had thought about it, at some point I realized that consciousness has something to do with it. I mentioned Heisenberg before, von Neumann, that's another scientist who contributed, Eugene Wigner, a Nobel laureate, who contributed to this idea. So there was no question that in my mind that consciousness is involved. But where people were failing, I felt, is that we don't really know what consciousness is. Most people were thinking consciousness as a brain phenomenon, as I did too. But I recognize that if it is a brain phenomenon, then it's a paradox, because brain itself is made up of quantum objects. And therefore, brain is a possibility until this measurement has occurred, which makes the brain actual. Before the measurement, brain itself is a possibility. So how can possibility, a possible brain, a possible observer looking at a possible electron, ever create a manifest electron? This is the problem to solve. When you put it that way, you really are confronted with the idea that how can brain generate consciousness? It just can't. So what is consciousness then if it is not the brain phenomenon? So I struggled and struggled and struggled, and then while talking to a mystic, all of a sudden, the way he was asking the questions made it very clear to me, this domain of potentiality that we talk about, that is consciousness. That is consciousness. So possibilities, brain possibility included, are all included within consciousness. Consciousness is choosing from itself, and therefore paradoxes can be avoided. And when consciousness chooses, then only we get manifestations. In the process, brain... Yep. Consciousness identifies with the brain, and that's how the brain comes in. So look at this, then what happened? How did I get there? So how I got there is precisely that I let my context change. I was not satisfied with the existing context. Everybody is thinking consciousness as brain phenomenon. They're not able to solve the measurement problem. As soon as I could jump out of that context and realize that consciousness is the ground of being in which brain exists as a possibility, complete change of context, then I could solve the problem. So in this way, same thing happened with Einstein that I talked before with relativity. So long as people were thinking within everything existing in time, they could not solve the problem of relativity. But as soon as Einstein realized that, no, it is not that way, it is time which is relative. Things don't move in time, but time itself is relative as other things, then immediately problem got solved, relativity of time. So it is always the change of context. When that happens, we are actually investigating the archetype of truth. We are not interested in the existing models of truth. We are going to what truth really is, and therefore we get to the basics of deeper truth, and this is what fundamental creativity is about. Okay? What a situational creativity, problem solving, that's always with relative truth. It talks only in terms of context that we already know.
Okay. Wow. Gosh, we're already halfway through the show. And we have hardly gotten all the way through the beginning of my questions. So I want to take just a quick one-minute break. There's one little commercial I want to play for you. Then when we come back, I'm going to want to skip to kind of out of order, but there is in your book, you talk about some synchronicities
that occurred in your creative life. And the reason that I kind of want to talk about them right after the commercial is because it has something to do with the commercial and actually a synchronicity with you that I had. So I want to go ahead and do that, and then we'll move on, okay?
Okay.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be back in 1 minute.
This is Roy Worley at MysticalShift.com. R.P. Sharp has done it again. His new book, It's No Secret, Spirituality Bites, with BITE, B-I-T-E, being an acronym for Bringing Inspiration to Earth, has once again hit a home run. Unlike R.P. Sharp's first book, Joy Potential, which was a uniquely original story containing a message of hope and inspiration for everyone regardless of where they happen to be on their personal spiritual path, It's No Secret is a compilation of awareness, insights, guidance, and wisdom that can help anyone navigate through their lives on a daily basis. It's No Secret also contains resources and references that enable a person to find expanded information on a variety of issues that affect all of us. Order It's No Secret today. I guarantee it will be a valuable resource for help with whatever your needs are.
Okay, everyone. Yeah, that was Roy. He was talking about my new book. It's called It's No Secret, Spirituality Bites. And, of course, It's No Secret was all about the law of attraction and how it doesn't work sometimes. But in the book, as he mentioned, I talk about various insights that I have gained from various authors and reading their books on my show. So in my book, I have one particular insight. It's called It's No Coincidence, and it happens to deal with the idea of coincidence and synchronicity. And Dr. Goswami, we're back. So I wanted to go ahead and, excuse me, one of the things, first of all, the synchronicity or the coincidence that happened that is connected to you, I have in my book. I mean, I have it listed. I talk a little bit about, you know, the idea of coincidence and synchronicity, and I'm going to want you to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But in it, I have a journal where I try to keep track of, you know, coincidences and little synchronicities, just as a reminder of when they happen and kind of reference back to them every once in a while. Well, in my journal, I had on October 15th of this year, this was the entry that I made. It says, in the morning, I receive an email from a publicist to have an author, Amit Goswami, back on my show, whose last appearance was almost 3 years ago. Later that day, I receive an email from a different publicist who read my review of Dr. Goswami's book I posted 3 years earlier on Amazon.com, requesting a review of her business partner's book, whose topic was related to the review I posted. Again, that review was 3 years ago, and it was on how quantum activism can save civilization. So back in July, and this was before Sierra sent me your book, and I read about how synchronicity played a part in your creative life. Here I am. I had this little thing happen that it was to me. To me, it was amazing, Dr. Goswami, because it was, I mean, that review was 3 years ago, and I hadn't heard a word in 3 years. And then the very afternoon after Sarah calls me in the morning, you know, someone references that. So
yeah.
To me, that was
yeah.
just interesting.
Yeah, that's quite meaningful, obviously, because you remember it so well. Yeah, this is the kind of thing. But it helps creativity. I mean, synchronicity is about meaning coming to a person because something else happened in the physical world that that seems like a coincidence. But it's more than coincidence because something is happening outside and something is happening inside. So can they happen because of a common cause? This is what can turn us on, and we recognize that, yes, the common cause is consciousness, of course. So all is movement in consciousness, so something physical can be very much be correlated with something mental in another being, another person. How it happened with me, the most spectacular series of coincidences that took place that I still sometimes marvel, because, you know, I started with a completely ignorant person on the subject of death and dying. I started because a woman on a talk show asked me, an old woman, and for her the concern is real, of course, is what happens when we die. And I have to acknowledge that I didn't know anything about it. And I also was a bit ashamed of it, that I didn't give much thought to this idea. Although, you know, when you change from material-based to consciousness-based, you realize that even when the brain dies, even when the body dies, consciousness really cannot die. So the basic problem of survival after death is already answered in terms of some positive insight that something in us, consciousness, that survives. But that is not really the answer people are looking for. There is also a personality. The question really is not about consciousness in its generality, but does our personality survive? Does something personal survive? So that question, of course, I was not ready to at all address, because I didn't know who we are. I have not really thought of anything in that direction. So time goes on, and after 3 months, another person, a theosophist, completely unbeknownst, unrelated to this old lady, starts coming to my office because he wants to take a reading course from me on the book, Self-Aware Universe. I talking quantum physics with him, but he is more interested in talking about, guess what, reincarnation with me. That's what theosophists are. They believe in reincarnation, and they want to push it, push their belief system with anybody, any willing participant they can find. And with me, he found a willing participant, because I was already a little intrigued. Okay, let's look at incarnation, reincarnation. So that went on for 10 weeks, for the quarter. Fine. And then a very, very interesting thing happened towards the end of that quarter, which is that I woke up from a dream, which became an admonition at the end. And I could hear the words very, very clearly. I can still hear it whenever I think of this episode. The dream was just this admonition. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is correct, and it's your job to prove it. So I really got motivated for that, you know, because given the Book of the Dead is, of course, something that I had read before. And, of course, I also not considered it very seriously, you know, because it's a soul's journey after death. And I just could not take it very seriously as a scientist. I read it because Richard Alpert Ramdas, also known as Ramdas, he recommended it. So I read it and I just, you know, put it away. And then it just became a very heavy thing. How does one prove the Tibetan Book of the Dead? And then the final synchronicity was a woman, a philosophy graduate student, called me and said that I want to see you. Why? Because my boyfriend died and I'm overwhelmed by mourning and I just cannot get out of this mindset, and somebody in my department says that you know all about consciousness and therefore you are the person that I want to talk to. And I'm flabbergasted. I say that, look, I'm not a therapist. I've never trained as a therapist. I know nothing about therapy. How can you possibly, and I know nothing about mourning. I'm completely incapable of giving you any helping hand. But she won't listen. So she said, no, everybody is saying that you are the person, so can I please come? So I gave up. I said, all right, come. So she was quite serious, and she was a very intelligent person. So I started talking to her seriously and about what it might be, that what does death involve and what dies, all these questions. And one day when I was talking to her, something she asked, which I don't remember anymore, but that gave me the entire solution to the problem. You know, this is a tremendous instance of 4 different coincidences guiding me towards a completely new way of looking at reincarnation. Because before, people thought a soul-like entity goes from one body to another, and of course that is not scientific. But what quantum physics allows us to think is completely different. It says that part of our memory, the character, the pattern of habit that we generate during our experiences of life on Earth, that part of us is actually non-local. We can call it non-local memory. So part of our memory is local in the brain, localized in the brain, so that part dies. Non-local means it exists outside of space and time in the domain of potentiality. So that part never dies. So now if there is a universal law that connects me to a future little kid, boy or girl, who inherits the same kind of habit pattern that I have acquired, then couldn't that person be called my reincarnation? So this basically gave me a completely new perspective and a completely valid scientific theory of how a soul can propagate from one life to another life. In other words, the quantum theory of reincarnation, which I published in the book Physics of the Soul.
Wow. You know, first of all, you know, the idea when you had, you know, those four coincidences, you know, it seems that whenever we are meant to be guided to something that is important for us, you know, in one way, shape, or form, you know, or our experience for us to experience, that it's if we don't get the first time, we'll get it reinforced again and again until our eyes kind of open and say, okay, I'll look at this.
Yes, you are totally right. So, you know, that's why people say, I don't know if you have read about the law of attraction, people say that these archetypes are attracted to us. If we don't notice them the first time, they will come again, and they will come again, and they will come again. So for me, I had a very dense consciousness, dense ego, and so it had to come four times before I recognized it.
Well, it was just real trained in that scientific method. That's all. So it kind of needed to break out of that a little bit. That's all.
It's hard to give that up, isn't it? Yes.
That's okay. But you know, but you do better than any scientist I know. That's for sure. One of the things that you also talk about in your book that I'd like for you to talk a little bit about is that you make a distinction between inner and outer creativity. I found that interesting. And would you mind explaining to the listener what each one is and what the difference is between those?
Yes, absolutely. And this is very basic. You know, I was reading a lot of the creativity literature during the whole involvement with consciousness research, because in quantum consciousness, creativity is a very important phenomenon, obviously, because the Newtonian is the past conditioning, fixity, determinism, whereas quantum is possibilities, new creativity, indeterministic. These are the key words of quantum physics. So it's very different. And so I was very much interested in this question of how the question of creativity can be relevant to an ordinary person. Because it is a fact that creativity of the kind that I do, for example, science, requires a lot of preparation. I mean, I had to go to graduate school and persevere to get my PhD and then be an apprentice with a mentor, and really, a lot of learning is involved. And same thing for being an artist, same thing for being a musician. So you cannot really say that an ordinary person would have any interest in being creative, which obviously in outer creativity requires a lot of talent. And then suddenly, one day, I realized there's this entire tradition before us, which is called the spiritual tradition. And there, you find people all the time, ordinary people, and they're motivated towards living better, towards making their internal ecosystem, internal living experience better. And how to do that? And everybody is motivated to do that, of course. Like you, I, everybody looks for love because we know that if you are in a loving framework, somebody loves you and you love somebody, the internal experience becomes very alive. And same thing for goodness, same thing for seeing beauty. These things, these archetypal things, are not entirely dependent on being a person of talent. We want to do it anyway. For example, you know, I don't have this problem of distinction between good and evil so much. You know, I am naturally good. I am naturally ethical. Wouldn't that be a much more desirable way to be than constantly suffering from this distinction of good and evil, negative and positive, negative emotions, positive emotions? Instead, if looking at someone always gives me the idea of positive. So this is ordinary people's motivation towards creativity. And I realize that what spiritual traditions have propagated, making spirituality a very mysterious thing, is wrong. Instead, it is just inner creativity. Creativity, the same process, the same creative process, the quantum thinking, do and be, the conscious processing of doing and unconscious processing of being. The same process is involved in also finding out whether I can love or whether I can see beauty, whether I can be just. These things involve also changing myself. So here the product is not externally situated, but I myself am the product. A new me is being created by my creative exploration of love. So that's the thinking behind inner creativity. Inner creativity then is a theory of what we normally call spiritual transformation.
Yeah, well, you know, I never really thought of that process of, you know, this spiritual development or understanding, or, you know, getting to the point of being, you know, in a state of love or happiness and not so much the other, as being creative, but very much our actions do impact the what we create, what our emotional, what we feel emotionally, you know, and what do we experience emotionally.
And if you think about it, why, you know, we go to church, we go to psychotherapists, why can't we change? If you look at it, what happens? Why can't we change? What is bothering us? What is bothering us are, of course, negative emotions. We have brain circuits, we call them instincts, and that promotes such emotional thinking as jealousy, competitiveness, anger, all that stuff, negative stuff. But how could we change that habit and being in love instead of jealousy? Somebody has a better car than me. Why should I be jealous? Let him enjoy. If I love him, I don't begrudge it. If my son gets a new car, then I don't dislike that. I'm proud of him. I'm right. The positive emotion has started to occur. Why is it negative when my neighbor has a large red wonderful BMW? So this is this is the point. Why can't we do it? Because we don't have a positive emotional brain circuit built into us. We have to do it by some process. And traditionally, we always have thought, and this is what Newtonian thinking does to us, that it's just a matter of thinking. You think good, okay, you love your neighbor. Jesus said that, and churches propose that, and they just teach, they read the Bible, love your neighbor, and you read other people talking the same way, maybe St. Francis, maybe a modern person. Fine, but that doesn't do any good. That's just Newtonian thinking. You try to love your neighbor and you fail. What do? You give up. So what really enables you to love your neighbor? So this, when you think about that, then you realize, well, maybe we should take quantum thinking. You should bring quantum thinking into action. So you think of all the ways that you could love your neighbor, like taking cookies to a neighbor, which many of us do, especially if we are women. Or you praise the car. Instead of being jealous of it, you overcome the jealousy and say, hey, you got a nice car, nice for you, good for you, BMW is very reliable and all this. That's one way. So you think of many ways and you do it. That's your do part. And then you just relax. You surrender. You think of the greater good and you just relax. Unconscious takes over. Quantum thinking. Be. So do be. You do this, do and be, alternatively. Pay attention to the neighbor, but also relax in between. and all of a sudden magic happens. You have a quantum insight, we call it a quantum leap, and you suddenly have learned to love your neighbor. Neighbor has become like your son, like your daughter, and you no longer begrudge that the neighbor has a big BMW. So, you know, this is the process. This is the process that I call inner creativity. Before there was jealousy, now there is love. Love in your brain, love in your as a brain circuit, so that you don't have to go to a church to remind yourself, love your neighbor. And that lasts only for a moment or two, as you know. But this brain circuit, once you have that, that lasts your life long.
Right.
And nobody has to tell you anymore.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, ever since then, that do has really taken on new meaning for me. So, and that's wonderful. Yeah, because you know, if you really kind of go into the whole quantum thinking mode, it's one of those cases of, you know, your neighbor and your even your enemy are all part of you, you know, in a sense. We're all part of that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
mm-hmm.
how we feel, act, and respond is what you're also responding, like thinking and acting to yourself. So there's one area I'd like to talk, you know, before we run out of time. We're down to about 9 minutes here. In your book, you indicate that creativity is easier in times of a paradigm shift. Now, I would first, I want to talk a little bit about paradigm shift, but also in addition to that, is creativity also easier in times of chaos? You know, because right now, a lot of my listeners and all that kind of, a lot of people seem to be going through somewhat of a chaotic life situation sometimes, you know. And so are those optimal situations for promoting creativity?
Yes. This chaos, let's take that one first because it's easier.
Okay.
You know, the Chinese ideogram for chaos means both danger and opportunity. So this is very interesting. Chaos or crisis in Chinese would represent both danger and opportunity. So we can take the danger aspect and be very fearful, but we can also take the opportunity aspect and become very creative about solving it. And lots of us are capable of seeing it as an opportunity for creativity, and we thrive in creativity when chaos hits us, when crisis hits us. So the first question that you asked, that of course is a major question, paradigm shift. Now, why is paradigm shift so interesting for creativity? Because when paradigm changes, the reason the paradigm has to shift is that the basic principles, the basic assumptions of the whole system, which you call the paradigm, is not working. Like right now, the paradigm has to shift from thinking in terms of matter-based, that we are material, to thinking in terms of consciousness-based, we are consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a major shift. That's a shift of such fundamental nature that the whole material way of thinking, whole systems have to be thrown away, and new systems have to develop in their place. For psychology, for biology, for all living systems, social sciences, everything has to be rebuilt from the basis, from the get-go. You cannot take anything of the old science for granted, although it will turn out that some part of the old science will remain in
mm-hmm.
some limits. But nevertheless, lots of new problems, and they're easy problems because these are very basic stuff. You don't have to learn a whole bunch of things in order to investigate the truth of, or to the reality of certain phenomena or manifest certain phenomena. And that's what makes creativity much easier to pursue, because you don't need this huge repertoire of knowledge. Like today, if you go into established systems of art or science, then you need a huge amount of new old learning that you have to understand and take years and years to practice, like mathematics, for example. But in the new science, mathematics has very little capacity. Mathematical thinking just doesn't work because consciousness is both subjective and objective. And therefore, all of a sudden, this restriction that you have to learn years and years of mathematics to do something like economics has to be dropped. No, mathematics is not going to be useful in economics. So economic students don't have to be scared of mathematics. And therefore, they can all be creative in the new economics without having to have this huge training in mathematics. So this is the kind of thing that I mean by that statement, that in times of paradigm shift, it becomes easier to pursue creative projects.
Well, wonderful. Gosh, well, you know, we're down to 4 minutes there, Dr. Ghazami. So, I mean, I could talk to you for hours. But, you know, what I'd like for maybe, if you wouldn't mind, in just in our closing moments, you know, if you wouldn't mind sharing with the listeners, you know, what should they take from from reading your book, Quantum Creativity, and maybe, you know, what are some ideas that we can, you know, implement to stimulate that in our lives?
Well, I think the most important idea can be just, you know, two ideas. One I already have talked about, doobie-doobie-doo, that basic idea of slowing down and relax part of the time. Creativity is not for those who are always busy, 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 do, do, do. Creativity fundamentally are better for those who know how to relax. So that changing of lifestyle, I think we need it. And I think you'll be better off for it if you learn to do practices, meditation, etc., which slows you down. We live in a very fast world. We need to slow down to be creative. And creativity is essential. As you know, we are suffering from huge gaps of creativity and entrepreneurship, which requires creativity, even in our businesses. So we really need you to be creative. And the requirement for that, the entrance requirement, is indeed the ability of doobie-doobie-doo, both doing and being. And the next thing that I would propose, we didn't talk about this yet, which is that creativity research shows that all of us who are ready to be creative, ready to explore creativity, have something in mind, a purpose in mind. Creativity is purposive. It's geared towards solving a problem for a purpose, for making something which has purpose, which serves us, which serves our living, how we live in the world. So remembering that, remembering the purposiveness of creativity, it is easy to comprehend that we all, when we become adults, we have a purpose in our minds. Now, the quantum theory I previously mentioned supports reincarnation. This purposiveness we actually bring from our past lives. So that is an important thing to discover. There is very good evidence that these moments of discovery, when we do that, they're called crystallizing experience, that really has a life-changing effect. All of a sudden, I have found a vocation which completely satisfies me. You know, I have found that in my own life. You know, I was very much scatterbrained in terms of my endeavors. My life was completely separate from what I did in my office, science. But then I had an experience where I started asking the question, why can't I integrate my life and my science? I discovered a new way of doing science, where science is done in an integrated way. It's not separate from life anymore, because science is based on consciousness. So in this way, you can do it too. You have your own vocation, your own creative destiny. Look for it. If you find it, you will find that life becomes bliss. The pursuit of that will never fail you to give satisfaction. Pursuit of that which you came here to do. You know, what is the meaning of my life? That question that haunts some of us, that will be forever answered. Okay. Well, this is the meaning of your particular life this time around. Okay?
That's wonderful. Yeah, I agree with you. Well, this has really been a delight. I really thank you for your time. I'll be sure to do a review on this book so that maybe 3 years down the road, somebody will come back and talk to me again, and you'll come back and talk to me again. Okay?
Of course. Thank you.
Okay,
Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Amit Goswami. We have been talking about his new book, Quantum Creativity, Think Quantum, Be Creative. And again, Dr. Goswami's book is available at Amazon.com. I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. And you can also find out more about him by visiting his website, which is amitgoswami.org. And I also have a link to that in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.